Hello, welcome to The Wire, where fresh coverage of independent news and current affairs from right around Australia comes to you on your local community radio station. I'm Roderick Chambers in Sydney, and coming up on the program today...
So the freedom movement or the front people believe that it's a grassroots movement and it's not white supremacists, but the behind the scenes are actually white supremacists. Basically, the neo-Nazi movement in Australia say that 50% of their recruits come from the freedom movement.
The killing of two police officers by a sovereign citizen supporter in Victoria's Alpine region illustrates the danger of the movement, with the internet being increasingly weaponised to promote violence and hatred through the proliferation of conspiracy theories. Stay tuned for this and more coming up on The Wire. There was immediate action after ASIO reported to Prime Minister Albanese that Iran was conclusively behind a number of anti-Semitic attacks in Australia, in particular the bombing of the synagogue in Melbourne and the Continental Bakery in Sydney. The embassy in Tehran was evacuated and the Iranian ambassador and three staff were also made persona non grata and told to leave. I asked Assistant Foreign Affairs Minister Matt Thistlethwaite to respond to criticism that the overseas actors we were told about after the attacks in Sydney and Melbourne were probably orchestrated from Iran and action should have been taken earlier.
Well, the government took the advice of ASIO and they were investigating some anti-Semitic attacks that occurred late last year. And when they'd gathered enough credible evidence to reach a conclusion that the Iranian government had directed at least two attacks, the Albanese government acted straight away. And we've acted to expel the Iranian ambassador, and we're making moves to legislate to list the Iranian Revolutionary Guard as a terrorist organisation.
So there's three other embassy staff which have also been expelled. Would they have been involved in intelligence activities?
Well, they've been expelled as part of the delegation. We leave those sort of things to ASIO. They advise the government and we make decisions based on their advice. But any foreign interference, particularly interference that jeopardises the lives of Australians, as these two attacks did, is completely unacceptable. And that's why we have strong foreign interference laws and that's why this government acted so quickly.
The Revolutionary Guard has been around since the Iranian Revolution. Why is it now that we've decided that it's a terrorist organisation?
Well, because we've now gathered credible evidence that they've been involved through operatives in working to create fear, stoke internal divisions and erode social cohesion in Australia. And
has it got more power in Iran, do you think, now than it did before?
Well, I mean, it's certainly been around for quite a while. It's well known that it's been involved in activities and foreign interference throughout the Middle East, but we won't tolerate any foreign interference by that organisation or by any foreign government in Australia.
Are you looking at the firebombing of the children's centre that was in your electorate, and is that something that could have been linked to the Iranian activities?
Well, there's still investigations going on into that. I'm in contact regularly with local police from the Eastern Beaches Local Area Command. They're keeping me appraised of that. In terms of further attacks and evidence linking Iranians to those, ASIO, the Director General, did make some comments yesterday. We'll await further advice from them, but there are further investigations going on.
It was close to a synagogue, wasn't it? They could have been people that were paid and made a mistake.
Yeah, that was the attack on the All About Children Centre in Maroubra. It was basically next door to the Mount Sinai Synagogue in Maroubra. And of course, there was anti-Semitic spray painting on the wall of the childcare centre. When that occurred, the Prime Minister and the Premier were there with me on the morning, and I expressed the shock and horror on behalf of our community, and the childcare centre is being rebuilt as we speak. So hopefully that'll be up and running very, very soon and things will return to normal for those families.
I understand that with the Australian Embassy in Tehran, that action was taken earlier to ensure that all of the staff were safe prior to this announcement that the Prime Minister made yesterday. How were the Australian Embassy staff evacuated from Tehran?
Yeah, that's correct. Before we made this announcement and before we expelled the Iranian ambassador, we made sure that the Australian diplomatic staff based in Tehran were safe. So those staff and their families were evacuated to a third country the day before we made the announcement.
What sort of reactions do you think we might get from Tehran and its allies?
Well, Tehran's and their representatives have already responded. We don't worry too much about that. What we worry about is keeping Australians safe. And that's why we've taken these strong actions. It's the first time since World War II that Australia has expelled a foreign ambassador. I think that highlights the seriousness of this issue. We will not accept at all any acts of aggression orchestrated by a foreign nation on Australian soil.
And finally, look, I understand there are still Australian citizens in Iran. If they are in trouble, what embassy should they go to? Like, who's representing us?
Well, we've had a warning to Australians for well over 12 months now not to travel to Iran and that it was unsafe. And there are some people who are Australian that are working and living in Iran, and we'd advise them to contact the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade through the Smart Traveller website or through the phone numbers listed there to get advice. But our advice remains the same, that they should return home to Australia as quickly as possible.
Foreign Affairs and Trade Assistant Minister Matt Thistlethwaite speaking with me there.
Hi, I'm Ray Martin. You're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio right across Australia. Stay well.
Teachers from the Palestine Technical College at Khan Yunis in Gaza have attempted to keep classes running amid blockades and bombardments. Displaced families are now living on the campus. Despite the lack of equipment and facilities, the teachers are persisting with e-learning for their students. Liz Kush asked Iyad Abu Salem, an electronics and communications engineer and lecturer at the college, how they are coping with these conditions.
No any way to say we are living. No, we are died, but breathing.
During this constant bombardment of Gaza during the last 2 years, what has happened to the college and its community?
In this war, we lost many of our colleagues, academic people. They held advanced degrees and held specializations. Some of them were martyred along their entire families. I mustn't forget the martyrdom of our students.
Could you please describe some of your experiences of the last 2 years?
The displacement for me, I record a new record in Guinness. 13 times I displaced from my house to Khan Yunis, Mawasi, moving to Rafah camp, again to Rafah west and Rafah east. And the last one was before 1 month. I came back again to Khan Yunis.
Could you describe what your life was like before this siege and bombardment began?
Gaza was beautiful. And the weather, here, the land, the sea, the people, everything is nice. And nothing forced us to get out from here, even the war. This is our homeland. We have to stay here. We have to be in our land. All the immigration and the transfer policy of Israel, I think it will fail. No one is going to leave.
In the midst of these conditions of extreme food shortages, unsafe shelter, and a very damaged health service. What has motivated you and your colleagues to reopen the Palestine Technical College? And what does this project represent for the community around you?
Along with that feeling of sense of responsibility toward our students, after the education process was halted, we worked hard to ensure the continuity of education and avoid wasting any further opportunity. We took the initiative to begin e-learning as a minimum. There was opportunity to arrange work in the college laboratory after humanity truce came into effect 6 months ago. However, with the failure of the truce and the return of the war, these attempts failed. And the people again came to the college buildings searching for a life.
Israel states that the purpose of its forced evacuations and military operations in Khan Yunis is to dismantle Hamas infrastructure and to target Hamas fighters. From where you stand in Khan Yunis, how does that focus compare with the realities that you and your community are experiencing?
The war is not against Hamas and its infrastructure. It is a big lie. It is a big Israeli lie. The war is against humanity and the basic necessity of life, including education and healthcare. And nowadays, there is a plan to displace the people of Gaza to certain countries in exchange of privileges that the United States and Israel will provide to those countries. It's an immigration plan. But all these attempts will fail due to steadfastness of the people of Gaza on their land.
Professor Iyad Abu Salim from Palestine Technical College in Khan Yunis, speaking there with Liz Cush. The murder of two police officers by an individual involved in the sovereign citizenship movement has highlighted the darker violent potential of conspiracy theories. Stephen Hill asked online extremism specialist Dr. Kaz Ross of the University of Tasmania to provide an overview of the sovereign citizen movement and the threat it can pose to human safety and to the working of institutions.
So the sovereign citizen movement, it's kind of an oxymoron, actually, because they themselves don't use the term sovereign citizen. They call themselves sovereigns. But this particular movement started a few decades ago in America, and we've had it here in various forms in Australia for quite some time. And generally, people believe that the current legal system is not legitimate. They believe that the Constitution is not legitimate and the flag is not legitimate. This doesn't mean that they believe in complete lawlessness. They think that there is a body of law. They call it common law. It's not what we understand as common law. But they think there's a body of law called common law that we should be going back to, that the Australian Constitution was changed illegally, that the real Australian flag is the red flag, the red ensign, rather than the blue flag, and that we need to sack the government. So it's a movement that's been around for quite a few years. In Australia, it's popped up in various places. People might know about micro-territories. There was the Kingdom of Hutt in Western Australia. Sovereign citizens have popped up into the media a few times, usually when they've disputed paying rates or taxes or fees or fines or something like that. And unfortunately, they end up in a lot of trouble with houses and businesses, cars being repossessed, having to go to jail and that kind of thing.
We saw another violent incident from a sovereign citizen. In the US, the movement has been designated a domestic terrorist group. Can you tell us how dangerous can sovereign citizen supporters become?
The sovereign citizens, or more accurately, we could call them pseudo-law litigants, can become dangerous in a number of ways. In a very mundane way, they're dangerous because they clog up the courts. So they turn up at the magistrate's court. They've got pages and pages of documents. They make a lot of pseudo-law arguments, which make no sense. And in the end, they always lose. But it takes up hundreds of hours of courts all around Australia are facing this problem. So in that way, they're clogging up our legal system. Referring to the potential for violence, they themselves would say that they're not violent. However, if you look at some of the sovereign citizen groups, and they might form what they call a citizens' assembly or a common law assembly. Now, some of these are very, very well organised. They hold court themselves according to their law. So it may surprise you to find that Scott Morrison has been tried for treason in one of these courts. They go to police stations and they serve warrants on the police to say you must issue a warrant for Scott Morrison or Dan Andrews or whoever their target is. Now, they themselves say that they have no power to enforce these orders. However, this is where the danger comes in, because these groups themselves are running around dressed in sheriff's uniforms. So it's a pretty short step from that to someone in that movement going, right, I've had it, the police aren't doing anything, I'll take it on myself and I'm going to hang Dan Andrews or whoever the politician is that they're targeting. So there's that danger. And then there's those that are not in organised groups, but they're in communities of fellow believers. Those people can be very isolated. And of course, the belief of sovereign citizens is that our laws don't apply to them. So they constantly end up running up against the police and running up against the legal system. And the incident that we saw this week, that chap was in court for about 20 times when he was trying to resolve a particular legal issue. So they get very frustrated. They feel very targeted by police because police are always stopping them. Their cars are unregistered. They're unlicensed drivers, so they shouldn't be on the roads. They don't recognise the authority of the police.
Much of the internet, in particular social media, in the way that it structures information, in that it's much more sort of personalised information delivery to maybe how we received information previously. Has this led into an increased reception of conspiracy theories?
Yeah, 100%. Most of these conspiracy theories, you wouldn't even hear about them if you weren't on the internet. And unfortunately, during COVID, people had a lot of time on their hands to go down those conspiracy rabbit holes. So we see two things about the internet. The first is groups of people can form communities, and they would never have met those people before. That's the thing about this so-called freedom movement online, is they're very accepting of some pretty way-out beliefs. So you can come along with any kind of belief about aliens or lizard people or Dan Andrews keeping children in towers under the streets of Melbourne, and you'll find other people who say, yeah, that sounds right. Yep, I believe you.
According to Dr. Kaz Rost, another dark effect of online silos is the way in which the white supremacist movement has been able to use the anxieties about COVID restrictions and other pseudo-legal beliefs to recruit individuals into the white nationalist movement.
Do you know about the August 31 march anti-migration? Yeah. And that's a really good example where, in actual fact, it's started by neo-Nazis, but they've convinced the freedom movement into thinking that they started it. So the freedom movement, all the front people, believe that it's a grassroots movement and it's not white supremacist, but the behind the scenes are actually white supremacists. Basically, the neo-Nazi movement in Australia say that 50% of their recruits come from the freedom movement. They see them as something to be shepherded in towards them and to radicalise them and get them saying Hitler wasn't such a bad bloke. And unfortunately, after 5 years, they're succeeding.
Dr. Kaz Ross from the University of Tasmania, speaking there with Stephen Hill. Quiet epidemic is occurring within the veterinarian industry. Australian vets are twice as likely to commit suicide. However, there is no national data to prove it. A new study from Griffith University on the Gold Coast sets out to probe this epidemic, aiming to uncover numerous thoughts and experiences of suicide from veterinarians at all levels across the country. If this story causes you or anyone you know concern, please do call Lifeline 131114. James Bale asked Dr. Alina Gadori from Griffith University's School of Applied Psychology what motivated her to begin this study.
My own why is I'm a veterinarian myself, and I've had my own struggles within the profession. I've also lost colleagues and classmates to suicide. And so something that's quite close to me and is part of the driver is to just start to protect when I started to look into what can be done to protect fellow colleagues from suicide, there's not a lot of research within this space. And so I just thought, hey, why not do a PhD and create some really robust research, because we've got lots of thoughts and opinions and theories, but we really do need more clarity, and we need the voice of the profession to help guide some evidence-based solutions.
When it does come to the veterinarian's risk of suicide, what factors have already been identified?
There's not a lot of research out there, and the research that does exist is quite dated or in isolation. You know, for some of the more recent data, in isolation, it doesn't really build into the whole pieces of the puzzle and why this is happening. And previous work has identified that workplace stressors are a factor, but we need to know exactly what in the workplace is, you know, happening for thoughts of suicide in our profession to arise. There has been a little bit of research done exploring, you know, moral injury, but we need to start to kind of look at the big picture and how that fits into the complexities of suicide and, you know, why thoughts of suicide are emerging and, you know, what we can be doing about it.
How many participants will it take to generate robust and legitimate statistics to support this study?
The program of the PhD research is three parts to the research. One is a cross-sectional survey or a nationwide survey, and as many registered vets from early career or new grad all the way up to retired registered vets, both clinical and non-clinical. Every voice matters. And so I need just as many participants as I can, and we'll work with the data that we do get to try and identify some of the pathways to why thoughts of suicide are emerging in our profession.
How do you hope the study will assist or educate in the industry when it comes to adapting workplace culture and practices?
Hopefully the findings will help address many different things. So hopefully reducing that stigma and really encouraging early help seeking, because that's really important for suicide prevention. Hopefully it will also start to identify and shine a light on some of the workplace stressors and the psychosocial hazards within the profession, because we keep saying we need to be addressing them, but we need to be a little bit more specific in what we're addressing. So then we can create more positive cultures, and it's going to be more evidence-informed and trauma-informed as well within our profession. And so then it creates the building blocks too, because this research, it's kind of the fundamentals and the baseline stuff that we need to start building on it. There's a lot of research gaps I'm already identifying. And so it will hopefully help start to shine a light on that so we can have targeted interventions to reduce the risk of suicide within the profession.
How would a study raise awareness about mental health in this sector to the wider community?
In many different ways. Certainly within the profession, we're all very aware that there's this heavy emotional and physical and psychological burden of being a veterinarian and what that looks like. And so within the profession, obviously, we can start to look out. We can identify early warning signs and know what to do and implement interventions to ensure that we don't lose any more of our colleagues. And then on a wider community, just create more awareness that when we think of vets, we just kind of think of pets and cats and dogs and stuff, but realizing that the role of a vet is so wide within our community. We're involved in public health and biosecurity. And so it's recognizing, you know, that there is these real challenges and ethical and moral decisions that we need to make on a kind of case-to-case basis that we're challenged with, because we go into the profession wanting to being taught to treat and manage patient care and animal care. And sometimes, you know, depending on the scenarios and situations, provide the care that we want to be providing, and knowing that we're trying our best to show up for the right reasons. And because there's being a vet is so complex and unique around that patient, client, or owner and veterinarian relationship, there's so many things to consider. We're all going to vet school to try and help an animal, and that's like we swore an oath. But because of the way the profession is set up, it comes with lots of different kind of factors that we need to work around and manage as well.
Dr. Alina Gadori there, speaking with James Bale. And that's it for The Wire today. You can find all of our stories online at thewire.org.au or subscribe to our podcasts. Just look for The Wire Radio. Today's program came from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3 here in Sydney and broadcast around the nation on the Community Radio Network. In Sydney, The Wire is produced on Gadigal country of the Eora Nation and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. We're going to be back again tomorrow, so do tune in again then. I'm Roderick Chambers. Do stay well and thanks for your company.